Welcome to Outward's December 2018 episode. I'm Christina Cotterucci, a staff writer at Slate and host of The Waves, Slate's podcast about women and gender. And I hope that everyone here has watched the Netflix Christmas movie The Princess Switch in preparation for the inevitable queer sequels, The Princess Top and The Princess Bottom.
I have not, but
it's so good.
Rotten Tomatoes tells me that it has 89%, so I don't know
what
I'm doing.
Actually, I love it, but that still somehow surprised me.
That's amazing. I'm Brian Lauder, editor of Outward, and I am just here to offer you your annual reminder that Lady Gaga once recorded a Christmas song that is about Christmas trees and sex and includes the immortal lyric, "Oh, oh, Christmas, my Christmas tree's delicious."
So
go listen to that.
I forgot about that song. I also love your
delivery. Go listen to that if you haven't heard it in a while or have never heard it, and it'll give you all the festivity that you could desire.
And I'm Brandon Tensley, the associate editor at New America and a contributing writer at Pacific Standard Magazine. And to be honest, I'm just glad that it's once again Mariah Carey season. Have y'all seen the adorable video of her singing All I Want for Christmas Is You with her kids as her backup singers?
No, I haven't.
No.
Oh, maybe my God. I should.
Yeah, it came out like a week ago, but it's a total diva move and it's totally Mariah Carey. So
back-to-back listening. We have it. We have a playlist for our listeners now.
All right. So obviously we're all getting into the holiday spirit of our secular seasonal camp. But this time of year is also a time when people embrace other kinds of spirituality, sometimes more so than they do around the other times of the year. You know, there's Christmas, and there's Hanukkah, and there's all sorts of other, like, friend celebrations of gratitude. So our theme for this month is spirituality. For us in this episode, it takes many forms: introspection, utopian futurism, organized religion, beliefs about the movements of the planets and their pull on our personalities and relationships and bodies. So we are going to take a broad look today at how LGBTQ people conceive of and organize their spiritual lives and practices. First, we're going to talk about why queers are so obsessed with astrology and the Enneagram. Then we're going to interview Leo Herrera, the writer and director of a short film series called The Father's Project, which imagines a world where AIDS never happened and where all the gays that we lost to the disease had lived. And then we'll hear from Laura Root, a gay woman who has chosen to stay in the Mormon church despite being excommunicated and despite its anti-gay policies and teachings. And finally, we will answer a question from a listener about how to define her sexuality when she's only attracted to certain kinds of women.
But first, we're going to kick things off with our December Pride and Provocations. As a reminder, prides are things our fellow queers have done that make us smile, whereas provocations are examples of bad queer behavior as upsetting as Bette Porter's infamous exhibition with the same name on The L Word. So I will kick things off, and this month I have a pride stemming from a provocation. Mm. So that provocation is the AIDS erasure in the tributes to H.W. Bush, who died at the end of November. So on the one hand, I understand the trickiness and the complexity of mourning. You know, a life is gone, and also that life was most likely not perfect, just like nobody is perfect. But what was so maddening to me was how detached so many of these tributes were from what I would consider just a historical reality. Mm-hmm. Few mentioned the, you know, his infamous record on race. They didn't really mention his silence on the AIDS crisis. They mainly focused on, you know, oh, he was this very decent person. He was a gentleman. He was the last of his sort of kind of genteel, I know, conservative. Essentially the opposite of Donald Trump, which is a low bar these days. But from that, what I saw and what I've been thinking about a lot over the past week or so is the very critical, affirming, and accurate remembrances that came from this, especially from queer folks who had actually lived through H.W. Bush's tenure. And so one I just want to highlight really quickly is it came from Masha Gessen at The New Yorker. And so she wrote, "In my early 20s, living in New York City, I often went to more than one memorial service a week. I was burying more of my peers than my grandparents were." And then she also wrote, "The tributes make it plain that our current experience of ordinary visibility is contingent. One minute we are here, and then a president dies, and we are gone." So I just thought about these lines a lot, and they were heartbreaking, but very affirming, but also maddening, and all these different emotions that have been swirling around for the past couple weeks. But, you know, on the whole, it essentially showed just how our empathy is very much limited by our memory.
Yeah, I also felt provoked by that. My provocation this month is not necessarily something that queer people are doing, but something that affects queer lives. And I learned about this in a piece in the Daily Beast last week. So every 2 years, the CDC does this nationwide study of high school students. It's called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. I've written about it a bunch. It's, you know, tells us what percentage of high schoolers have had sex and what are they using drugs and, like, are they drinking and are they depressed? But only since 2015 have they been asking students to also identify whether they're lesbian, gay, or bi. They still don't ask about gender identity. But, you know, it's been super helpful and important because there's just a real lack of data about what LGB lives are like in high schools. Now, according to a study in the American Journal of Public Health, these researchers have found that there's a bunch of teen boys, it's almost exclusively boys, who are lying on the surveys and saying that they're gay and also blind and also deaf and 8 feet tall and have used heroin 50 times and weigh 666 pounds just to kind of like be funny and throw off the data. And so luckily there's ways for researchers to account for this, like basically looking at all the ridiculous outliers on some of these surveys. And because at first they were like, wow, LGB students are like way more likely to be deaf and are like a foot taller than their peers. Like, what's going on here? And then they realized that there were just these certain surveys where people had just basically, you know, completely lied because they thought it'd be funny to pretend they were gay. So this provokes me in a very primal sense because it just awakens these horrible memories I have of being in middle school and high school with boys like these who like thought being gay was a hilarious joke and also just got a kick out of sort of making life harder for people who were trying to do good things like collect surveys that help you deliver services to people who need them. I'm currently writing a piece about suicidality in LGBT youth. And a lot of the data that I'm looking at is from the CDC and from this survey, which, again, it's only been done twice where they're collecting data on these populations. And so it just makes me so mad that some people, that it's still like fun and funny in high school to A, say you're gay when you're not, and then B, like, fuck things up for people who are trying to get very necessary data.
Wasn't there like a small bit of I read that story too. Wasn't there a small piece of good news from it though, which is that it seemed like the at least around I think it was just substance abuse, like this realizing this and accounting for it actually made it clear that LGB youth were not as equally as likely as other groups to be abusing those substances.
Yeah.
I feel like that's like a piece of, you know, at least, you know, that's not as bad as we maybe thought it was before.
Yeah. So there was actually good news to come out of the survey once they were able to account for these mischievous, no good high school students. But yeah, the fact that they're doing it is still provoking to me.
Yeah. I'm also just like imagining like this is how you would like to spend your limited amount of time on Earth is like messing up a survey. Like it just sounds like a colossal waste of time. But, you know, high school kids, I guess.
Boys. Yeah. Yeah. So I have a pride this month. I just went to a really wonderful Christmas concert here in New York. My mom was in town, and so we went to do that, and it was wonderful. And you know, it was one of these things where they had multiple choirs and an orchestra, and you know, it was in a cathedral here. It was really beautiful. But watching that, I was reminded of all of the gay choir directors, music directors, church organists, who particularly in December bring all the drama and spectacle of gay sensibility into their various houses of worship for Christmas concerts.
Aww.
This is a thing that I think happens across the country. And, you know, some of these folks are out, some of them are not out necessarily. But it's a time of year when you can really feel, I think, gay aesthetics and gay presence in these spaces. And it was, you know, this concert was beautiful, and I know there will be many others. So when you're at your local, if you go to a local like Christmas cantata or something like that, just take note of the gay gift that's being given to you by those folks.
Oh. I love the word cantata. It sounds very gay. It sounds like a gay dessert that you would make, Brian.
Oh, absolutely. Doesn't it? Yeah, we should make one. We should invent one.
Okay, so for our first themed segment today, We're going to talk about why queers love astrology and the Enneagram. So for the uninitiated, the Enneagram is sort of a philosophy of personality types. It's based around a diagram that has the numbers 1 through 9 going around a circle and then connected by lines that make sort of like a star without a bottom. And it's sort of a self-identification system. You can take a personality test or just sort of read through the 9 personality types and call yourself one of them. And then depending on what number you are and that number's relation to the other numbers in the circle, you might have different attributes from the different other personality types too. For this segment, we would like to invite our producer, Daniel Schrader, to join the conversation because, proud Virgo that he is, he has insisted from the very beginning of this podcast that we have an astrology segment. Hi, Daniel. Welcome.
Hi, y'all. I'm so excited to be here.
We know. Okay, so the animating question of this segment is one that I would like you to answer first, since you are maybe the most excited out of all of us for this. What about astrology appeals to you as a queer person?
But wait. Shouldn't we say
yes?
Oh, do we have to
first
identify
we should
ourselves?
Go
because I don't think we can have this conversation honestly and productively without knowing.
Well, of course not.
All of these things.
No.
So, Daniel, what are
so
your
I'll
sun?
Start. Yeah. I'm a Virgo sun on the Leo cusp with a Leo rising and a Taurus moon.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
I'm unprepared for this.
Christina.
I'm a Sagittarius cusp of Scorpio.
All I know is that I'm a Gemini Cancer cusp. I don't know about any moons or
here.
Rising.
You have so many cuspings. I'm a Virgo sun, Taurus rising, and Pisces moon, which is very important to me.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the reason that I love astrology, specifically from a queer perspective, is because like it feels magical. It feels fun. It embraces the seriousness and lack of seriousness of itself all at once. And that in itself feels like a queer experience to me. And I think it offers a lot of the same spiritual benefits of something like an organized religion without having to go through all of the problems of how organized religions feel about gay people. And so I think it's just pure fun, but then is also very helpful at the same time.
Yeah, I feel like it's I don't want to speak for everyone else, but I feel like my engagement with it is definitely not on the order of like, I really think that this planet is going backwards and like doing this. You know, Mercury's in retrograde, which means Mercury's actually going backwards and like doing something to me. But rather, it just offers this like fun and kind of like structuring slightly a little bit, like interpretive frame to the chaos of the world.
Even if
I know for it, like in my heart that it's not real, like it that doesn't really matter.
It lets me queer science.
Ooh, huh. I love that.
Yeah, I think there's also an element of self-determination to it, even though it is based on your birthday and birth time and all that. I mean, even more so with the Enneagram, where you literally just call yourself one of the 9 personality types. I think the astrology is not prescriptive. It offers sort of a narrative frame that you can apply however you want to your own life. And, you know, as you mentioned, Daniel, queer people have sort of been denied a lot of opportunities for meaning making and for, you know, dreaming up or remembering these coherent and historically consequential narratives for our own lives connected to something larger than ourselves, like the planets. And I also wonder if because LGBT people often can't participate as our full selves in many religions, the way that those religions treat queer people might just be turning a lot of us off to organized religion in general. Like, even though there are a lot of churches that are very accepting of queer people and have queer leaders and whatever, I wonder if a lot of those interpretations of, you know, Christianity and what have you that are moralizing and anti-sex and anti-diversity and sexual expression, that queer people are like, well, maybe that's all bunk and I'm going to think about the planets instead.
Yeah, like for me, I feel like the thing with astrology is that there is absolutely a performance element to it. Very similar to like what you're saying, right? Where it's not prescriptive, it's quite abstract in a lot of ways. And so like I feel like there's just this opportunity for queer people to really bend the parts of themselves that they want into whatever it is that this thing is supposed to be. And so you're just assigned this role/identity, and you can really just like take it and run with it and do whatever you want with it. And I think it's hilarious when one of my friends, so just like, oh God, you're such a Gemini Cancer cusp.
Another thing I just thought of when you were kind of listing all these things off, like I'm a Taurus sun and a Virgo moon and this thing rising and this other thing cusp. I think about the way a lot of introductions go if you're at like a queer conference or some sort of, you know, consciousness raising workshop. Mm. And it's like, you know, I'm a cis switch femme who's into kink and like mm-hmm. identifies as blah and part of X community. And like I have this whole list of identities. And I think for all that queer people, hate labels or being boxed in or having binaries in other ways, we really like those things or
absolutely.
Having characters to inhabit and also feeling seen and feeling like, you know, we've introspected the shit out of ourselves and know ourselves super well and can also know intimate things about other people before we even enter our first conversation with them.
I think that's so true. Like I was thinking about like why do we care? Why do we like these systems so much? I think there are a lot of reasons, but one that seems pretty basic to me is we're used to thinking categorically about ourselves as queer people from the word go, because you have to, you're deciding where do I fit into the acronym or whatever, and what are the gradations of that and all of that. And so it makes so perfect sense that we would naturally be then inclined to find something interesting in another system that's much, much like that, actually.
Yeah, I would also say that in my experience, it gives us another language to communicate with, like another common shared gay language, because whenever I am at a queer Brooklyn party, everyone within 5 minutes is like, oh, are you on CoStar? Which is a astrology. Oh, bless your hearts. CoStar is the most important app of 2018.
Oh my God. As ranked by Daniel Schrader, yes,
and every Brooklyn queer you'll meet. But it is an app where you can sign up, you can sign in and put your date of birth, time of birth, location, and it gives you your birth chart in a very like beautiful way. But then also you can link up with your friends, and then it will give you your compatibilities.
Oh,
so
wow.
It will tell you like, oh, well, because you are a like Virgo Mercury, that's going to conflict with this person who's like an Aries Mercury. And it'll explain like why. And so it just kind of is a very quick shorthand to understand like the type of person someone is, either A, if they're into it or not, or B, like what they actually are. Like, I know I always end up trying to date an Aries and I shouldn't. And so I've like learned that about myself.
Well, here's a question actually that brings up, like, do y'all actually use astrology to make decisions? So like whether about dating, I will completely confess that I used it last night to decide whether or not to go to a holiday party. Because I didn't feel like it really. I was sort of, and this, I think this is probably like the worst kind of astrology, but I, and in some ways it was like flipping a coin, honestly. But I did pull up my daily astrology reading, and it said that I would benefit from being social that day. And so I went, and I didn't feel like, and it was fine. It was fun. So I'm kind of glad I did. But
oh, interesting.
I wonder how often, you know, y'all actually use it in that way, like as a direction giving thing.
I have literally never used it for anything.
I went through a phase in third grade where I was obsessed with my Sagittarian identity and like reading every book about it and completely identified with it, in part because I think it's a very flattering sign. It's like,
some
I'm adventurous, like life of the party, loves to have fun. So I'm like, yes, yes, yes. But I,
that's such a childhood Sagittarius thing to do.
It was. And I think I have fun with astrology more than I rely on it for anything serious. Although I think your scenario, Brian, could be like why some people say flipping a coin is useful, because then as soon as the coin flips, you realize you were hoping for one thing over another. So even
sure.
just reading something, it could help clarify for you what you think about something else. But I think that I actually thought this was a funny piece that I found online on them.us, and the subhead on the article, it was like the queer astrology skeptics, and the subhead was, not all queer people believe in astrology, and those who don't often feel alienated from the LGBTQ+ community at large. So I think in some circles, it really is sort of a given that people would take astrology seriously and might do something like look at your whatever co-star ratings and say like, oh, I'm going to avoid that person because, you know, our signs clash. One other great part of that them article was it said that many people told the author that they feel stigmatized by the larger queer community for their beliefs, that is, their belief that astrology isn't real, and they would not allow their full names to be published for fear of being stigmatized.
Wow. Reprisals. Oh, my God.
They're probably all Aquariuses.
So this brings me to the Enneagram, because this is something that a subset of my circle of friends really loves, and I hate it so much, I think in part because of the way it was pitched to me, which was, you know, a lot of my friends trying to identify me and my partner without our consent. And this is really supposed to be a self-identifying thing. So a lot of people were like, oh, you're such a 4, and like, oh, your partner's such an 8, and all these other things. And I felt like that they were sort of relying on stereotypes to identify us as Enneagrams, and that, you know, sometimes I'm a hard ass in my relationship. And I was like, just because I'm the more feminine partner doesn't mean that I'm the one that's like more take charge, and that she's not the one who's more like soft and tender and melancholy and whatever. Then I took the Enneagram personality test and it put me as a 4. So clearly I my anger was misplaced. But this is all a long way of saying that I asked those friends, you know, why do you think queer people love Enneagrams so much? And they're like, actually, I think it kind of can trace back to specific people, that it may not be a cultural phenomenon, but just that queer circles can be so small that if one person, as, you know, 3 degrees removed from me, apparently there's a queer person, a trans guy whose brother is also queer and trans. They were both raised with the Enneagram, like by their parents. They were an Enneagram family. And then they ended up teaching it to all their friends and partners and, you know, partners, friends and whatever. And then those people taught it to their friends and partners, friends. And now all of a sudden, a lot of us think Enneagram is a queer thing, and maybe it's not.
Well, I remember like in college, one of my friends in particular was so into the Enneagram. Like she only half jokingly like would refuse to meet a new person until she knew like what their type was.
Oh, wow.
And I was just like, this is like really extreme. Because what I wonder is like, is there a sort of like feedback loop with this thing? Like, oh, somebody says that you're this, and so on some level, are you going to start sort of like embodying that or thinking like, I don't know. I say this because I hate my type is the 3, which is the achiever, which is essentially a way of saying that I am shallow and self-centered and I'm a monster. Not even in the good Nicki Minaj way. Like, you know, I'm a motherfucking monster. Just like, no, like you need help. but I also was thinking like, so many of these things do seem true, but I wonder if like I'm going to start like, I don't know, not buying into it necessarily, but just using it as a sort of like crutch to like explain away some things, where it's like, actually, that's maybe not true, but just because something told you it's true or like it's accurate doesn't mean it. So I don't know. I always think about like which direction some of these things work in after a certain point.
Or to explain away other people's behaviors, like, oh, you're such a whatever, you know, like, oh, no, actually, that was a completely idiosyncratic decision that I made that has nothing to do with this, you know, framework that may or may not be relevant to my life.
Well, see, I like the Enneagram was new to me, actually, when I took the test for the podcast, and I found it much more like the tone of it I didn't like as much as like compared to astrology. Like it felt more judgy and kind of diagnostic, which I guess maybe that's the point, but it didn't like astrology types like being a Virgo or like a Pisces moon, like those are these like almost, what do I want to say, like literary or like metaphorical sort of spaces that are a little looser that you can inhabit and see good in. And it's not about saying like this is a adaptive quality or a maladaptive quality or something. It's like this is like a constellation of sort of tendencies that you might have.
Whereas, I see what you did there.
Yeah, thank you. whereas the Enneagram, it felt much more like a psychologist diagnosing you, and I reacted sort of viscerally against it as well. I do feel like it only picked up on the Virgo aspects. I've been talking, I was a type one with wing and two or something like that. You know, I think some of that stuff is true, but I think it missed a lot of my emotional life, actually, that because of the kinds of questions it asked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're nodding your head, yeah.
So actually, I wish June were here to talk about this with us, because while she is not an Enneagram person either, her partner is. And I mentioned to her earlier today about, like, I wish she was going to be on this chat with us. And we were talking about the difference between astrology and Enneagrams, because I don't really like Enneagrams. I don't like Myers-Briggs. I don't like things where I have to take a test that then I get to answer questions about myself and it tells me what I am. It feels very narcissistic in a way that astrology isn't, because astrology feels more outside in than inside out. Mm. And June said that her partner framed it as, astrology is a pseudoscience, Enneagram is a pseudo-philosophy. I guess maybe I don't think that pseudo is the right use there. I think maybe in a way to think about it is, like, Enneagrams could let you queer philosophy the way that I believe that astrology lets you queer science. But I think that Enneagrams, they are too broad in a way that astrology isn't, even though it is, because, yeah, everything, it comes down to some sort of stereotype. But, like, there are so many specifics in astrology, like your sun, your moon, your rising, your Mercury, your like all the planets where they're placed, and then also where all those planets are placed in relation to each other, that could possibly have influences on you if you believe astrology. Whereas, like, Enneagrams, it's just nine numbers and how those numbers interact.
I do think, and this is informed by one of the Enneagram-loving friends who I talked to before coming on the show today. She phrased it like this. I'm going to sort of paraphrase her. Queerness can be a space for unpacking and questioning things in one's life that the sort of, like, hetero, cis, white, hetero patriarchy does not allow for. And it's just a way of thinking about human behavior in a new way. And there's also some sort of sense of magic, too, that I think astrology has, where it's, you know, a fun thing to think about and to, like, a lens to place over your life to give you a new sense of, you know, meaning or reason. And I also learned from a different friend who loves the Enneagram, who is an ex-evangelical, that evangelical Christians love the Enneagram, too. In fact, her mom recently took an Enneagram class at her evangelical church. And another thing that queers love, the five love languages, also has its origins in Christianity. And I learned while researching astrology that the church was, like, a main purveyor or sponsor of astrology in its early stages. And so I think that there is some overlap between these frameworks that queers are drawn to and the sorts of religion and the sorts of things that religions are trying to give people too, like a way to understand your own relationships and a way to build self-awareness and introspection and outrospection.
It like makes sense in that it's like you're trying to find meaning in things. And I think what makes it fun is the fact that you keep it at a level that's like fun. Like the way that you used it, Brian, right?
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention, well, two things. First, I think that there is a special connection between lesbians and queer women and astrology and some of this, like, new age healing stuff, in part because women's lib and gay rights movements kind of gained steam around the same time that new age spirituality was gaining proponents in the West, but also because religions are extremely patriarchal and have glorified men over women. And so I think a lot of women have felt drawn to, like, witchiness and Wicca and, you know, the planets. You've got, like, periods and the moon, and, you know, even, like, a common menstrual cup is called the Luna cup, because, like, the moon and, like, women and fertility and blah. And so I you know, there's a connection that I don't think we should elide. The second thing that I got thinking about when I read the them.us article about queer skeptics who are being ostracized from their communities because they don't believe in astrology. Some of these ostracized skeptics were saying that they think they want to caution queer people not to get too into astrology because they think it'll make us more liable to get taken advantage of by con people and crooks. And that, you know, if we're focusing on this sort of like self-realization and introspection and stuff, we're going to, it's going to be like the opiate of the masses, and we're going to completely ignore these systemic oppressions that we face. Someone just sighed on the other end of the microphone.
Yeah, that's so boring.
So what you're saying is that like... CoStar is stealing my data.
I feel like we're smarter than that. I'm kind of not worried.
Yeah.
Queers are the scammers. We're not getting scammed.
That's right. No, I mean, we are capable of enjoying something with, you know, tongue firmly planted in cheek and knowing what it is and what it isn't. And, you know, and I think there's a pleasure to be taken in rebelling a bit against those kinds of folks that you just were mentioning, Christina, and these like even larger systems that, you know, we've always had to do that. So it is, again, not surprising to me that we take a certain amount of glee in seeming to reject like science, even though most of us aren't actually doing that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Daniel. You added so much star and sparkle to this conversation.
Of course. This was a blast, guys. Thanks for having me.
The new Star series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. You've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Stars and the Stars app.
The Father's Project is a web series built as an answer to a deceptively simple question. What if AIDS had never happened? What would queer life look like today if all those we lost to the disease had lived? In the show, creator Leo Herrera imagines that we'd be living in something close to a queer utopia, with vibrant queer colonies spread across the U.S., a gay presidential candidate in the 2020 election, and community-designed poppers that cure all STIs. We're excited to have Leo with us today to discuss his vision and his profound faith in the ability of queer people to transform the world. But first, let's listen to a clip from the second episode, which dropped earlier this month.
By the 90s, gay disco culture had penetrated the mainstream so deeply that rush poppers were advertised to housewives on daytime TV, and colonies received government subsidies to build gay clubs the size of cathedrals, to revitalize local economies. Stonewall Nation has become a global destination for entertainment and decadence. This influx of people and freedom had its consequences. At the end of the 90s, a rise in venereal disease posed a threat to the health of the colonies. However, the government offered little assistance for this, so Stonewall Nation funded the GMHF to develop a solution. What resulted was the most innovative medical advancement since antibiotics.
Imagine poppers that protect you from STIs. Introducing Espera, the first inhalable prophylactic developed by the Gay Men's Health Force. Espera prevents the sexual transmission.
So Leo,
of viruses.
Thanks so much for jumping on the phone with us today. So, you know, I spoke a little bit about what the Father's Project web series sort of looks like and what the narrative in it is, to the extent that there's a narrative. But I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about the origin of this idea, because it's such a surprising and somewhat sensitive one, I think, you know, to imagine this. So where did it come from for you, and how did you start developing it?
The original idea for Fathers basically came out of necessity, like all big ideas, I guess. There's such a generational gap. And during the community conversations about PrEP, I realized the scope of the lack of older men we have to talk to about certain issues. And I've always, PrEP is Truvada, which is a daily pill that you can now take that prevents the transmission of HIV. So it's a huge game changer, and it can prevent transmission up to 99.9% if taken daily. So we basically have our first real protection against transmitting the disease. And when that first came out, there was a huge community uproar and a really divisive issue about our own sexuality, the way we were expressing it. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of slut shaming going on. There was a lot of survivors that were really, really terrified. You could really feel the fear in the air during mm-hmm. that time, which was, I think, 2014. And I was really, really confused about the issue myself. And I had just started dating somebody who was HIV positive. And I just basically didn't know what to do. And it dawned on me that, you know, there wasn't anybody that I could call. And so, as is the case with a lot of queer history stuff, the answers are there. So you get to research a lot of, you know, the sexual liberation, pre-AIDS, how much AIDS changed, and then sort of the project. It started off as a imaginary cure for AIDS, and then it just kind of morphed into this idea of like, what if it just never happened?
In the first episode, there's this beautiful scene, sort of, I think it's actually in the prologue, if I'm not mistaken, where you have some sisters of perpetual indulgence do a kind of ritual. And this episode of the podcast is about queer spirituality. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that particular scene, about where it seems like you almost have them, I don't know if you would say raising the dead or sort of doing something. They're in an AIDS memorial with a lot of names, and they're doing this sort of beautiful ritual. So could you explain a little bit about your thinking with that?
Well, actually, all of the Father's Project, except for really, really small selected scenes for the gay president sequences, are all real life rituals, or they're real life events. That particular event was the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence were doing a ritual for this gay activist named Hank Wilson, who created all sorts of organizations in San Francisco, and they were basically canonizing him that day. And so I kind of took that, layered it with this other scene that we shot in New Orleans of this leather man hanging out by a tree, and this little kid happened to show up that day with his lesbian moms. It's like the way that Fathers works is so crazy, because there's so many of these weird, eerie coincidences that happen. And it's sort of my job to kind of channel all of this like spirituality part of it and make a cohesive narrative, which can be really, really difficult and time consuming. But that particular sister scenes was something that they actually do, which is canonize saints. And I took that and basically appropriated it into the story of them imagining if they were doing something like that. But
what
it was
are
to
some
raise
of your other favorite moments of sort of queer ritual and witchiness that you came across in doing the research and filming for this?
I mean, I've always been drawn to that kind of ritual, that queer ritual. So a lot of the stuff that I decided to film for Fathers is stuff that I've experienced before. There's a lot of stuff that I couldn't shoot just because some of it's really private. Right. For example, some of the radical fairy sanctuaries that I've been part of for a lot of years, that I go to, you know, Beltane, those kinds of things. They're really beautiful and they're really ritual based. A lot of the more obscure alternative queer rituals actually take from Native American rituals, especially within the radical fairy community, because of the relationship that, for example, the founder of the Radical Fairies, Harry Hay, had with the Native American, this idea that, you know, Native Americans had a two-spirit entity within their community that was revered. So, you know, trans people, gender-fluid people, they were thought to be pretty much magical, and they were revered as such. So a lot of these rituals that the Radical Fairies take from borrow from a lot of those pagan and Native American stuff. So if you go to some place like, if you go to a Beltane ritual at one of the radical fairy sanctuaries in the United States, you see a lot of ritual, and it's really emotional, and it's really, really beautiful.
Something that's much more accessible, like nightlife, seems to be a similarly kind of magical or spiritual kind of space. And you shoot that really and show that really beautifully, I think, in the second episode. So what does nightlife mean to you in this sense?
There's no doubt that there's a reason that a lot of gay men have called, you know, their nightclubs their church. The second episode opens with Stephen Pevner, who is a nightlife legend in New York,
who continued the tradition
of the Saint George. Mm-hmm. And he produces the Black Party every year, and that's our longest running gay event. It's been going on 40 years now. What he talks about is how nightlife and the lights and the sounds and the music and the people and the loss of identity for that minute creates a kind of a religious ecstasy for people that's very similar to gospel churches, for example. And a lot of our nightlife is based on that. Gay men and gay people pretty much invented nightlife as we know it today.
One thing that I love about the spirituality element of your series is, like you said, all the footage was taken from real queer communities, and then you sort of spin them as footage from these imagined queer-only colonies. And so watching it, it sort of made me think about the fact that this utopia that you're imagining sort of lives among us now in some form. But also, when we think about AIDS, I want to say that it's the second episode of Fathers where somebody says, see all these people, imagine a third are gone. That's what AIDS was like. To me, that was it seemed almost like a biblical plague, like or a genocide, or like a tragic supernatural sort of reaping. And it's definitely been portrayed that way, obviously, by like fundamentalist religions, anti-gay religious sects who believe it was sort of a punishment for promiscuous behavior. How do you think about how queer people today can sort of reimagine those narratives and reclaim them for ourselves?
I asked a really famous gay activist one time I was in a car with him for like 7 hours. We were traveling to go to Washington, D.C. to interview a senator about HIV criminalization. And on the way back, I asked him what's something that had been weighed on me and weighs, I think, on a lot of gay men, whether AIDS was a punishment. And he told me AIDS was not a punishment. AIDS was about neglect. I think for me and for the project, and Stephen Pevner calls it a biblical plague, I think if we're able to spin it in that way for ourselves and sort of give it the narrative weight that it deserves within our community, I think that there's a lot of healing that can happen through that. This Greek tragedy, this biblical plague, this moment that is so monumental and isn't that far gone, I think that there's a lot that we can learn about ourselves and what we're built from.
So one thing that I really loved about watching these episodes was that it just really allows queer people this sort of creative thinking and fantasy that straight people have always had. And it works as a sort of permission to do that. At the same time, I'm also wondering what some of the reactions have been. I'm wondering if, in particular, you've had any sort of pushback.
I feel like most of the work that I try to do and have always tried to do has been to kind of put a mirror up to people. And I think a lot of art does that. Initially, when I ask survivors the question during those interviews, that's the most difficult part, because it's like the question just slaps them across the face. And it's
the question being what
if really
this hadn't
awkward
happened?
When I say, yeah, when we are doing interviews, mm-hmm. and I just flat out say, what would the world look like if AIDS had never happened? And it's important for me to record that brain process, because it for most survivors, it doesn't even fit in there anymore, because the scope of it is so large. That's the only initial pushback that I get. And I get contradictory answers, because there's so many schools of thought about what the world would look like and what AIDS actually did for the community or took away from it. But after the episodes come out and most survivors see that I've interviewed them, feature their interviews, I mean, people need to understand that it's not like I just pretend it never happened and then create this really exciting future. We include the interviews with survivors in the opening of every episode, because you have to give that moment that time, and you have to remind people like this is very real. And I'm glad that you mentioned that shot where he says a third of these people would be dead, because that was really important for that episode. The only pushback I've gotten, I think, is more of I've got a couple of bad comments on World AIDS Day that people were like, this isn't what we should be thinking of. Mm. But most of those people haven't watched the episode. I think they just see the headline. I know it's that same thing. So they just see the headline. And I try to engage with them when I can. I usually don't go into comments if they're really negative or whatever. But there was a few where buried within this really intense comment section was, he says, you know, I'm 57 years old. I would look ridiculous on a dance floor. And I thought, oh, man, like, this is the heart of the project. Like, the reason that you think you would look ridiculous is because there's not a lot of 57-year-olds on the dance floor. So you feel alone, and you don't know that there are a lot of places that I've seen firsthand that, you know, there's a lot of 57-year-olds on the dance floor. I dance with a lot of older men in my dance floors, for example. And so that's where I think a lot of the pushback, for example, for that person was, I think it comes from loneliness and from this fear and from this survivor guilt and from this really deep-seated jealousy of this generation, especially now that PrEP has come out. There's a whole wave of older gay men that feel like they may have missed some kind of boat. So there's a lot of that stuff comes out, but for the most part, it's all very positive. And I think people see the amount of effort that goes into it.
I wonder if it also has to do with some of the pressures that some gay men might feel to be young and ageless, or the idea that, you know, to be part of gay culture, you have to be on a dance floor. In certain cultures, there just hasn't been a lot of space made for people who live a quieter gay life and might, you know, engage their social lives or their spirituality in other ways.
Yeah, those tend to be the people that I don't get to reach too much, which is people that are like, you know, I haven't gone out in 15 years. And that's more of a human thing than a gay thing, I've noticed. Especially if you are familiar with gay history, you realize that the older gay man had a revered place, because, you know, I mean, I always say that my generation is the last first generation, meaning like, we're able to pass down information a lot more, especially now that we have all this technology, if we use it right. Every generation had to start from scratch, every gay generation, because either the closet and law enforcement, and of course AIDS, then following AIDS, you know, there was a huge silence moment between the generations. So if you don't kind of go out and search that history, or you search that culture, it atrophies, like your ability to communicate with your community. It's like a muscle. And the happier older gay men that I've met through the Radical Fairies, through the Gay Burning Man community, through San Francisco, through these like circuit parties, all of that stuff. The gay men that I know that are happier as they get older are the ones that make the effort to continue to place themselves into these situations. And it's scary. I mean, every gay bar is terrifying.
It's true.
Edmund White has a line in, I think it's his book, The Farewell Symphony, where he talks about how he's in a gay bar and it's like 1969 or something. And he just says how every gay man in that place is scared to be there. And I think once you remember that, I never forgot that, because it's social anxiety for us. It's
thank
so
you
prevalent.
So much for joining us. And thank you for making this wonderful project. I think it's really, really special. And I hope our listeners will go out and watch it. Yeah. Can you tell folks where they can see it and learn more about the project?
Absolutely. You can head over to ifthaylive.org. All episodes are going to go up there. There's a lot of content that's being put up there. We have a queer art shop to raise funds from queer art by queer artists for queer artists, and tax deductible donations through the Gay and Lesbian the GLBT mm-hmm. Historical Society here in San Francisco.
All right.
So
thank you so much.
There's a lot to see and a lot coming up. Thank you very much.
So we've talked about some of the less traditional ways in which queer people sometimes approach spirituality and religion. So we're going to turn now to a much more complex and barbed relationship, how some queer people reconcile organized religion and queerness, given that religion has long been used in various ways to oppress LGBTQ people. It's no surprise that for many queers, there seem to be only two real options: renounce their religion or their sexuality. To talk about these dueling pressures, we're going to hear a story from Laura Root, a gay woman who's a member of Affirmation, an organization for LGBTQ Mormons and their allies. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Laura Root. I'm 48 years old, and I currently live in Boise, Idaho. I was raised in the LDS Church and was an active member my whole life, right up until recently. This past spring, I was excommunicated from the LDS Church. There were little glimpses about my sexuality throughout my whole life, but for the most part, I just tucked those things away. And it wasn't until I was 44 years old that I really began to be honest with myself about my sexuality. So about 4.5 years ago, it sort of sort of hit me like a ton of bricks that, oh, holy cow, I'm gay and I'm Mormon. And that took me into about a year long depression and just trying to sort through those two things, because I thought, I can't really be gay and Mormon at the same time. And how am I going to do that? Eventually I worked through some of those things, both with a professional counselor, as well as just working on my own relationship with God, and came to a point where I was comfortable with myself and my sexuality. And then I came out publicly. I told my parents first, and then I told my siblings, and I think they were horrified, to be honest, but initially expressed their love for me, and they just really hoped that I wasn't going to get involved with another woman. And when I did, they really struggled with that. I had some of my family members say that I was ruining our eternal family. One of my brother's family didn't want my then girlfriend and I to be around at Christmas time. They wouldn't let us be around their kids. This was a couple of years ago. But since then, they've all come around, and they're pretty accepting of us for the most part. I don't think they still love that I'm married to a woman, but they've really come a long way. In fact, this next weekend, we're going to be getting together with my family at the family Christmas gathering over in Eastern Idaho. And my wife is welcome to come, and they want her to be there. And so we're happily going. Since I grew up LDS, I learned about, first of all, the importance of a personal relationship with God. And I was taught how to pray. I was taught about the importance of prayer. And I was taught that, you know, if I have a sincere heart and I have faith in my heart, when I go to God with honest and sincere questions, that God will let me know the things that he wants to guide me in my life on. So I was on my knees a lot. I had a lot of tears, and it was really, really hard. And eventually, I believe it was through prayer, God let me know in my heart that I am 100% accepted by him, and that I am exactly who I'm supposed to be. Being Mormon is just as much a part of my identity as my sexuality. And I see the LDS Church really as my tribe. We speak the same language. It's an organization that I spent decades serving in and communing with the people within that church. And I love the church, and I love the people in the church. I do have to say that the way that the church and the church leadership, their policies on LGBTQ issues are reprehensible, and I can't say anything to defend their position because I don't agree with it. But I do, you know, as I think about this, I get this question a lot, and I guess the way I've resolved it in my own mind is I think of the church the same way I might think about a good friend or a close family member who was, you know, doing things that I thought they shouldn't be doing. I still love them. And my belief is that eventually at some point they'll come around and get it right on this issue, because I do think they have it wrong, and they don't know they have it wrong. You know, I go to church and I kind of have to armor up a little bit, because I know I might hear something that is painful or offensive or hurtful. There are other LGBTQ Mormons who think I'm kind of stupid, frankly, that I can for continuing to go to church. They feel like it's harmful, that the church itself is harmful and damaging to this community. And I do agree to that, or I do agree with that to a point. So on the one hand, you know, the members of the LDS Church give me a hard time for being in a gay marriage, and many members of the gay community give me a hard time for continuing to attend this church that has policies and practices that are very harmful to the LGBTQ community. Yeah, so I'm sort of caught in the middle, and that's one of the reasons why I've tried to maintain my personal relationship with God and simply do what I feel like is the best thing for me to do. And to stay away from what other groups of people are telling me that they think, what they think I should do what I feel like I need to do.
Now we're going to get to some advice. We have a question from Valentina, a listener. Her question is someone attracted to the same gender if they only like lesbian or gay people? I have found myself attracted to lesbian and bi women, but never felt attracted even the slightest to straight women, no matter how sexy or beautiful. Who wants to take the question first?
I'll start. I'll say that yes, if you're attracted to the same gender, if you only like lesbian gay people. I mean, the way that I was thinking about it earlier was it's a not corrosive version of people having types, I guess. I have a lot of queer friends who, you know, they're a gay man and they're just like, oh, like I just am not into very like straight presenting dudes. And, you know, I think part of that stems from like a various reasons, kind of like what that sort of presentation presents to a person who's queer, right? It can be something that's a huge turnoff. It can be something that's a sign of like danger or something that's just uninviting. And so it seems like an almost, it makes sense to me when I kind of like talk about it out loud that like you would be attracted to queer people, but not necessarily straight people.
Yeah. I mean, anybody in any sexual orientation is not attracted to every person of whatever gender or genders they're attracted to. I also think it makes a lot of sense to only be attracted to people who might also be attracted to you or like know how to have sex with you or something like that. But I would also question how this person knows that all the people they're attracted to are lesbians or bi women. The fact that she states it with such certainty makes me think that maybe she's attracted to masculine of center or gender nonconforming women because, you know, there are a lot of people who you might think are straight but who actually aren't. And in that case, you know, that's also a type that a lot of people have and that people, you know, talk openly and freely about is not something.
Yeah,
to
the only thing I would add to
queer.
I think y'all are both right. The only thing I would add to that is this just sort of brings to mind the fact that, you know, when we talk about sexual orientation, I think a lot of times we think about it in a very sort of medical or biological sense, right? Like, so if I'm gay, that means that I'm a man who's attracted to men. But I think actually what this question is picking up on a little bit is that, like, it may be orientation may be as much cultural as it is biological. To be gay,
yes.
I think, means to be, I don't even know if attracted to is the right word, but like interested in gay people, like or other, you know, like other people, men who are in that same sort of universe. I might notice like other straight guys and think that like a straight guy is good looking, but I'm actually not like interested in that person because we're not in the same space, right? So I think that that's kind of what this question is picking up on a little bit, is that orientation is probably as much a cultural thing as it is a biological thing, and it maybe is more helpful to think about those two elements together.
I'll also say that one of the gayest people I know, a Slate coworker who I will not name because I did not get their permission, but who identifies basically with every letter on the LGBTQ+ spectrum, says and takes great pride in the fact that they're only attracted to queer people, even queer people mm-hmm. who might not know they're queer yet. And I admire that, and I kind of don't doubt that, because I think a lot of times people who might not have ever had a queer relationship or self-identify that way will sometimes give off a vibe when they're mm-hmm. around visibly queer people or people who they
resonate.
Know are
yep,
LGBT.
For sure. I agree. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they totally resonate. It was a great question. Thank you so much for sending it, Valentina. If any of our current listeners have questions they'd like us to weigh in on, please send us an email at outwardpodcast@slate.com.
All right, that's about it for Outward this week. But before we go, we'd like to send you off with your monthly gay agenda. Sticking with our theme for this month, we're going to talk about a queer experience or object or something that took us to church. So that was sort of a spiritual encounter for us. So Brandon, what do you have?
So I am a cliche of myself, as everyone knows by this point. So my gay agenda item, which I mean very sincerely and earnestly, is the Immaculate Collection. So Madonna's first greatest hits compilation album from 1990, which, you know, was a great year.
Was that when you were born or
it
something?
Was.
Okay, got it.
So I listened to the album while I was prepping for this. And really one of the first things that kind of jumped out to me was just how much religion and spirituality are salted sort of with queerness and vice versa across the album. So, you know, you have the more sort of like on the nose, obvious references to religion, right? So the title itself, you know, is a reference to Immaculate Conception. You have the wildly popular songs like a Prayer. But what really jumped out to me was just how much spirituality-like feelings permeate across the album. And so, for instance, I'm thinking of a song like Lucky Star, on which Madonna says, "Shine your heavenly body tonight, because I know you're going to make everything all right." Or like one song I've been listening to on repeat for like the past week while prepping for this episode is Cherish, right? Where it's this song that is about devotion. And so while I think, like so many good pop albums, like it's an album that's about love, I think a more accurate descriptor is probably that it's an album about devotion. And I think what's so cool about it is, you know, for Madonna, it almost works as its own sort of devotional prayer book. And she is sort of retooling the sort of spirituality-like devotion, you know, turning it from something that's heavenly and, you know, sort of aiming it at a more sort of earthly, sort of like love, which I think is something that resonates, obviously, not just with, you know, straight people, but is something that allows a lot of like queer creativity and imagining. And, you know, if you combine that with the fact that Madonna is, you know, a huge gay icon, it all makes sense. And so I remember just listening to particular songs on the album when I was little, and I was just like, ooh, I feel like the way that she's talking about it is not the way that like we would talk about it in church, but also this feels right. And so that is my gay agenda item. Who's going to go next? Christina?
I'll go next. I would like to recommend The Great Believers. It's a new-ish novel by one of my favorite authors, Rebecca Mackay. It came out in June, but I'm just getting around to reading it now. So this is a story with two parallel timelines. One is in the mid-80s, following a group of gay men, and one gay man in particular, in Chicago as they work and live and love.
The L-word song.
I just said the L-word theme song, basically. Loving, living, loving, living. And you know, they're confronting the AIDS epidemic. And the other story, you know, the chapters sort of switch back and forth between the two. The other one is 30 years later, 2015, where the sister of one of the men who was lost to AIDS, but whose chosen family was that group of gay men, she's in Paris trying to find her estranged daughter who was sucked into this fundamentalist religious cult. This actually would have been a good book to talk about in our family episode too, but it's really immersed me in the idea of queer spirituality. And especially as it relates to the AIDS epidemic, the way people reckon with and understand senseless tragedy and the generational repercussions of those tragedies and finding meaning in histories, imagining futures. One of the storylines has to do with art and communities of artists and belief and hope. I love this book. I mean, I love the author, Rebecca Mackay. I also highly recommend her collection of short stories, Music for Wartime. But in this book, as in all her work, all of the characters are so beautifully and vividly rendered and singular, even in this circle of gay men, which I think could have been really easy to write in sort of broad strokes. I mean, all of them have very different philosophies about this plague that they're facing and their ways of healing and their ways of finding transcendence in the midst of that. I really can't recommend it enough. It's gotten a lot of acclaim this year, but I think especially for queer people, you know, even though the straight media has been praising
that
it, I think we should claim it as our own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's called The Great Believers.
I'm gonna pick that up.
Great Believers.
So Christmas when I think about where I sort of have my queer spiritual, you know, moments of transcendence, it's often in whether it's in a physical space or engaging with like an art piece, is something like Leo's web series, where it's a true queer vision that I'm able to sort of be enveloped in and just sit there with it, right? So another example of that I've been really loving recently is a new podcast called Dream Boy. It is coming from the folks who make Night Vale, if you're familiar with that podcast, and it's made by this artist and composer and writer called Dane Terry. And it's a tough like story to sort of relay, so I'm not going to try to do that too much, but basically the narrator is also named Dane. He's a gay guy who works at a zoo in Cleveland where there is a murderous zebra, and it's very nocturnal. The mood is very atmospheric and kind of weird, like Night Vale is. And there are drag queens and a lot of discussion of Grindr and really hot gay sex scenes with audio that's particularly interesting. I don't think we get a lot of that. Lots of frightening dreams, and it's got this beautiful score, and the production's just gorgeous. It's a real queer piece of art, and it's very exciting, and it's sort of ongoing now. I think it started in October, and they're doing like an episode, it seems like, every 2 weeks or so. So definitely go check that out, and I suspect it will give you a little bit of a spiritual experience. It certainly has me.
Oh, that sounds so good.
It really does.
And I'm about to have a pretty long car ride to go visit family for the holidays, so yeah. Definitely listen to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we hope you enjoyed the show. Please send us feedback, topic ideas, and advice questions at outwardpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook or Twitter at Slate Outward. Thank you to Danielle Hewitt, who provided production assistance for this episode. Our producer is Daniel Schrader. Slate Podcast's senior managing producer, June Thomas, is Quoth Mariah, All We Want for Christmas. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, and rate and review the show so others can find it. We'll be back in your feeds on January 16th with an episode on queer travel. Stay gay while on holiday, Brian and Christina.
No problem.
Stay gay, Brandon.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.